What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to lose some pride, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, soil, to be brought down to earth, to bite the dust, to be laid low. In that sense, maybe a humbling can never actually be welcomed in as great. We would never wish for this encounter with mortality on a planetary scale, but here we are. If this is a humbling, then maybe it's about a regrounding, a reconnection in which we are being made to stare into the dark mirror and reflect on the reflection we see staring back at us. Perhaps there's a message in that image. My name's Ed Gillespie, and myself and my co-host Dougald Hine have spent the last 20 years trying to decipher and articulate that message. How will they look in hindsight, these strange times we are living through? Is this a midlife crisis on humanity's road to the Star Trek future, or the point at which that story of the future unraveled and we came to see how much it had left out? What if our current crises are neither an obstacle to be overcome, nor the end of the world, but a necessary humbling? In the early weeks of the coronavirus crisis and the extraordinary rupture of the everyday that it represents, we set out to explore what it means to be humbled.
Ed, here we are. It's the first week in April. We wanted to talk this week about the question of recovery, of what comes after a crisis like this, and specifically the thought that we can't afford an economic recovery. So we'll come around to that in a minute, but I thought maybe it's a good idea just to start by reflecting on where we are. What's been on your mind? What have you been reading that made sense to you this week, Ed?
Yeah, and I think it's always going to be one of these movable feasts because things seem to shift on a sort of almost daily basis right now. But I was drawn to a short story, which is written by E.M. Foster back in 1909, called The Machine Stops. And like all of the best insights, I can't actually remember where I first stumbled upon this, such as the gargantuan amount of what Baudelaire would say, you know, you have to drink an ocean in order to piss a teacup of insight. And I very much feel like I've been drinking oceans at the moment. But The Machine Stops is quite an incredible sort of insight into a dystopian human future where everyone has ended up living underground. Under the regime and regulatory control, if you like, of a machine. So there's all sorts of Wachowski brothers type matrix type connotations to it. I'm sure the Wachowski brothers must have drawn some inspiration from The Machine Stops. And basically humanity spends its time underground. All its needs, physical needs, are met. And then they pass their hours, if you like, in the exchange of secondhand ideas. So it's a bit like the kind of the fake news of the internet. It's sort of oddly prescient. And the two central characters, one sort of sneaks off to the upper world, you know, returns to the wild and savage world above. And comes back to tell his mum. He goes, I've been above ground. And, you know, it's quite an extraordinary place, and talks about the beauty of the nature and the fact that there are other human beings living up there beyond the machine. Meanwhile, the kind of the role of the machine becomes doubled down. It becomes, they form a sort of quasi religious thing called technopoly, where, you know, the humans start to worship the machine. And they forget that they actually created the machine and they treat it as almost like this mystical entity whose needs then begin to supersede their own.
And then one day it stops.
And then one day the machine stops and the whole thing falls apart. And they realize that actually it's that connection with the above world where humans have been surviving and flourishing. There's a thing that really matters. And that it will be up to those surface people to be able to rebuild the world. So, I mean, it's a very crude, in some ways, economic metaphor as well, because this is the machine that we have built for ourselves. It's a very big question as to what aspects of that service that the machine provides we might want to keep or preserve, and which ones might need to be put to one side. And so I found that a really fascinating, quite timeless parable, you know, written over a century ago. And then the other thing I've been reading is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. which is written by an esteemed botanist who has American Indian heritage. And it's her exploration, I guess, of a combination of science and nature and indigenous wisdom and soul and soil and culture. And one of the things that's really struck me from that book is this American Indian idea of the honorable harvest, which is an unwritten code, a culture of practice about how to have a relationship with the land, which is relational, not transactional. And it's always, it actually speaks in many ways very powerfully, I think, to a much larger question about society and the economy. And, you know, some of the key elements of the Honourable Harvest are know the ways of the ones who take care of you so that you may take care of them. And you can extrapolate that to perhaps frontline staff at the moment. You know, health workers, people who are providing and maintaining the viability of the food delivery systems that we're coming to depend on, you know, teachers, etc. And there's a really lovely balance in it about, you know, take only what you need, take only that which is given, never take more than half, harvest in a way that minimizes harm, never waste what you've taken, share and give thanks for what you've been given. And there's a deeply ingrained reciprocity and respect and value that underpins all of that, which, you know, I think feels quite anathema to much of our economic narrative.
Well, I mean, I read that book last year as well, and you described it very well. The thing that strikes me is the contrast almost between these two ways of relating to the world. The being dependent on a machine that you take for granted until it stops working.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that great phrase, infrastructure is the stuff that you don't notice until it stops working. And the attention to and awareness of the things on which you depend that Robin Wall Kimmerer is writing about, and this attitude, this attempt to live in such a way as to be worthy of the cost of your life, which feels a very long way away. I mean, it's a beautiful book. It's an inspiring book. It's one that's actually, it's had this fascinating sort of momentum as a phenomenon because it was published by a small publisher 6 years ago, and it's gradually spread by word of mouth to the point where around the beginning of this year, it hit the New York Times bestseller list, which is, that's really not how the publishing industry works. That's not how you have a New York Times bestseller. So it's quite remarkable. But there can also be a sort of a sadness or a difficulty when we're confronted by those the kind of the standards of the honourable harvest, with how hard it is to imagine how you could get from the way we are living to something that would have that balance of being aware of and worthy of all of the taking that goes into your being alive.
And I think what I really enjoy about the book, and I'm not finished it actually, I'm about two thirds of the way through, but is the way that she's very honest about those tensions. And she talks very frankly and candidly about the imperfections and the inconsistencies and the contradictions in her own life. Knowing as she does such deep sort of scientific understanding of the way the plant and natural world functions from a botanical perspective, but also, you know, coming at it with that idealism, perhaps from, you know, the slight romanticization of indigenous wisdom, but, and then also, you know, her own flawed and challenged existence in trying to honor both of those kind of slightly conflicting worlds.
There's a lovely bit early on where she talks about one of her classes of students and how she asks them for examples of damaging human relationships with the living world. And, you know, they have loads and loads of examples they can come up with. And then she asks them for examples of helpful human relationships to the living world, contexts in which our relationship to wild nature and to things that live and grow is giving rather than destroying. And they're they're sort of flawed by this. They don't know any examples. Their whole kind of conception of what it's like to be human is actually bound up with the idea that we are inevitably a destructive species. And I suppose that connects to a book that I've been reading this week, Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell. It's one of those books I've known about for years and meant to get round to reading. And somehow this moment that we're in, this crisis that we're in, made me go, yeah, it's time to pull that one off the shelf. And it's about what she calls disaster utopias, the kind of moments in the middle of and in the aftermath of ruptures, disasters. She looks at five particular examples, from the San Francisco earthquake and fire of 1906 through to Hurricane Katrina, and the ways in which humans come together and even flourish in the middle and in the aftermath of what are, you know, in many ways horrific moments for those who are worst affected by them. And part of what Solnit is doing in the book is she wants to question the stories we've been told about human nature. And she wants to draw on these historical examples of the conviviality, the mutual aid that tends to occur between ordinary people whose lives have been thrown into chaos by disasters and catastrophes, and how this gives the lie to the kind of Hobbesian story or the kind of social Darwinist story of the war of all against all, and that the only thing that is preventing us all from a nightmare of rape and pillage is the civilizing force of top-down structures of power. And so as you were talking about the Robin Wall Kimmerer book, it strikes me that, you know, there's a parallel there between this story of humans as inevitably destructive of the living world and this story of humans as these kinds of monsters who are only kind of held in place by top-down structures of power and domination and control. But the other thing that struck me reading it was it brings into focus the strangeness of this particular crisis that we're in the middle of, which is that there is no coming together in the way that people are normally thrown together by crisis. You know, Solnit talks about how researchers who look at what happens in the aftermath of disasters find that actually people on the whole don't panic. But there is this thing of elite panic, where you get these huge overreactions and these kind of projections and fantasies about the horrors that are playing out, and therefore the necessity of sending in the military, as happened in the aftermath of Katrina. But apart from in endless Zoom calls, we don't have the opportunity to be thrown together and come together, and therefore, you know, the full opportunity for discovering what human beings are really like in the middle of this crisis. And that's part of the strangeness of what's going on, I guess.
I mean, what we're seeing is obviously a very strong virtual aspect of that, through the sort of mutual aid groups and people doing that kind of indirect support, or perhaps direct support if they're doing shopping and things for people. And there is that very strong community connection, but it is, you know, it's weirdly virtual. When we did the big clap for the NHS here last Thursday, you know, it's very striking, because in one sense it is a beautiful moment of collective reflection and solidarity and paying tribute and acknowledgement to the challenge and sacrifice being faced by the health system and key workers and others. And at the same time, it's sort of, it's weirdly atomized, because you're sort of waving from balcony to balcony or doorstep to doorstep.
So one of the things that comes through from the Solnit book is that these moments during and after a disaster can be moments of questioning and reconfiguring, and of not simply returning to how things were before. And she tells the story of the Mexican earthquake in the mid-1980s and how it actually transformed in many ways Mexican politics and Mexican society, because there was a kind of a critical loss of faith in some of the forces of the existing system and a renewal of confidence in the possibility of living otherwise that came out of the way that people responded at community level to the crisis. And I think maybe that's what we wanted to point to in this conversation, is that despite the limitations that are there in the nature of this crisis on the ability to actually physically come together, there has to be some conversation starting now about the extent to which we cannot afford to go back to the trajectory of economic growth that we were on. And just to pin this down, there's a paper from the journal New Political Economy by Georges Kallis and Jason Hickel that came out in April last year called Is Green Growth Possible? So they're looking at these stories that we have about the decoupling of carbon emissions from economic growth, the decoupling of resource use from economic growth. And they look at all of both the historical evidence and the models for projecting future trajectories. And their conclusion is pretty damning. There is no solid basis for believing that it is possible to combine the trajectories of economic growth, the long-term trends of around 3% year-on-year growth that we have been used to and actually dependent on in the way that our societies and economies are organized, with having a chance at keeping the worst of climate change at bay. What strikes me is that more and more people inside organizations, institutions, governments have been brought to this point of recognizing, at least quietly and privately, this incompatibility between the growth assumption and the ecological predicament. But you get there and you're at this event horizon. For example, Macron came into the meeting that he had with Greta Thunberg in February last year. And according to a friend of mine who's been working with Greta, he basically said, the reason why France can't bring its emissions down is our economic growth. But just because you've admitted and acknowledged that doesn't mean that you have any political moves that will allow you to act on that. Because propelling a country, a society, an economy across the line from the reality we know, in which the growth assumption is foundational and built into the way that whole parts of our economy and social system work, into a reality where that growth trajectory is no longer there, it's hard to imagine how any politician can actually make that move. So I have this picture of them sort of standing at this event horizon line, helplessly. And now suddenly this virus comes from left field and throws us across that line, because we're looking at absolutely extraordinary numbers in terms of the short to medium term economic impact of this. A third of economic activity being wiped out. You know, this is off the map, certainly on a global scale. We've seen nothing like this in modern times. No. So are we then going to have an almighty effort to bring us back across that line, to return us to the world that we were in 6 weeks ago? Or is there some way of people coming together in this moment to have the conversation about, you know, why we can't afford a recovery, an economic recovery, at least in conventionally conceived terms?
And exactly. And I think, you know, in that sense, and I hold my hand up here because, again, I would have previously been an advocate of that very sort of green growth, you know, or the kind of just one more push type of mentality, the Green New Deal. You know, we can save the economy and save the environment at the same time. That is sort of Red Queen, Alice in Wonderland sort of territory, isn't it? It's wanting to believe six impossible things before breakfast. I totally understand why people cling to that, because it does feel hopeful. It feels like the right kind of pragmatism. And yet we also know, if you go back to Jevons' paradox you know, during the Industrial Revolution, when William Jevon talked about, you know, when you increase the efficiency of the use of a resource, you tend to just, you drop its price and you increase its consumption. And, you know, and he was saying that about coal in the mid 19th century, yet we know that with all of natural resources today. So the concern I think we have, if we don't address this conversation, is we either have, you know, an enormous rebound effect coming out of the other end of this crisis, where we replicate the roaring 20s and we come out the back of like the 1918 flu influenza epidemic, and we go into this crazy decade, which then leads to the hideousness of the 30s, you know, or we have something similar to a post-Second World War settlement, where we have a very different conversation about the social contract and the social settlement, which is what gave birth to the NHS and the Arts Council and some of these incredible institutions. Because my concern, I think, is if we don't get into that, then we end up with a stimulus package, you know, which is essentially the resuscitation of the patient on the mortuary table, which we did in 2008, which was an absolute disaster for the climate. It just triggered another decade of relatively high carbon growth, which is all in the context of, you know, Darth Vader's Death Star and economics, where it's like, you know, the construction of our new Death Star is a fantastic job creation opportunity. And you can hear that mantra, you know, where people are saying it's got to sound like growth. Whatever we do next has got to sound like growth. And again, I think linguistically, we quite like the idea of growth. Growth always sounds good. But then does that necessarily have to be this economic growth? Because growth does not equal security and well-being, which is what people actually want. You know, we've had, you know, decades now of, you know, the failure of supposed trickle down economics. We've got massive accumulation of wealth in the 1%, and that, you know, rentier economy has been partly driving some of this populism and restlessness from the people who have been held back. And so I think this is precisely the moment to be having this incredibly difficult conversation, because we're revaluing what different roles people play in the economy. And we talk about key workers, you know, who a month ago were low skilled workers and now they've been repositioned as key workers. But even the value of unpaid care services in the UK is around about £1.2 trillion a year. That's people looking after children, relatives, the you know, mobility impaired or the disabled. That is bigger than the size of the whole UK economy. And yet that is not economically valued at all right now. And what the crisis has done has suddenly put a huge value on realizing that these are the things which are meaningful and purposeful and actually make society work. And so I think to start to have these conversations, I think that the first question that people have is like, well, where is any money going to come from? Because people go, where is the wealth creation? And I guess that's the live debate, is like, what does it mean to be wealthy? And, you know, what does flourishing and thriving look like beyond a measure of economic success, like the insanity, which is GDP, which even Simon Kuznets, who developed it, said, you know, whatever you do, don't use this to measure quality of life.
So there are all sorts of technical conversations which are kind of above my pay grade, frankly, about the economics, the monetary questions, debt, and so on, about how you restart things or reshape things. But something that I'd be interested in hearing more from you about, Ed, is the degree to which there was already something building up before this crisis came along that might then be catalyzed in the space that the crisis opens up, which is a willingness amongst people on the inside of institutions, corporations, organizations to face how deep the mess we're in is. You know, I haven't had the same degree of exposure that you've had through your work to those kind of insider worlds. But what I've tended to get over the years, and more, is people quietly getting in touch with me because they've read things that I've written that are making sense to them. And so I end up having these strange conversations. So in October 2018, I was sat in a cafe at the Eurostar terminal in Brussels on my way to London. I got a message on Facebook from somebody I'd never met who wanted to meet up. And it became clear as we sat and talked that part of what they wanted to talk about was exactly this sense of things coming to a boiling point or a breaking point internally within the kinds of organizations they were working with. So this was someone who was working with an organization that's closely connected to the European institutions. They had just been involved in producing a report on the future of shipping, where they had basically had to make the assumption that I think it was 50% of the entire electricity production of Europe in 2030 would be going into producing the synthetic fuels to keep the container ships coming from China. And what was clear to them was that in other offices, in other organizations around that city, other people were producing reports for other sectors that were spending 50, 60, 80% of Europe's entire projected electricity production for 2030 to keep other sectors going in the way that they currently operate on the trajectories they're currently on. So in other words, that total budget of sustainable green electricity was being spent again and again and again in order that everybody's bosses could go on pretending that the commitments to decarbonisation didn't call into question the growth assumption. So the question, the conversation we were having there that October was, how do you begin a conversation about this without simply becoming somebody who no one listens to? Mm. And my sense is that there was already a kind of direction of travel around this over the last 18 months, 2 years, since the beginning of the new climate movements that we saw in 2018 with Extinction Rebellion and the school strikes, a kind of parallel thing going on more quietly inside of organizations. And, you know, I was back in Brussels last May speaking at the European Commission alongside Jem Bendel, who wrote the Deep Adaptation paper, Alison Green from Extinction Rebellion. And what I remember saying that day was, what's at stake is no longer sustainability. It's not sustaining our current ways of living and our economies, because whatever sustainability once meant, it always ends up meaning sustaining the current way of living of maybe 1 in 7 people on the planet, and the promise that that way of living can somehow be extended to the other 6. What's at stake now is negotiating the surrender of that way of living. And I said to them, you know, just look around you at the activity that makes up the economy. How much of it could go away, not by 2050 or 2030 or 2025, but just overnight? And if no one became hungry or homeless as a result, no one would really miss it. And that felt like this wild thought experiment less than a year ago. And now here we are in the middle of actually a version of that experiment. And I guess what I'm interested in is, from your experiences and the networks you're connected to, the conversations you're part of, how ready do you feel people are to actually pick up that experiment and run with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, it really depends on which sector you're in. I think, you know, there's a big discussion about, is this a pause or is this a reset? You know, what is the psychology of what is going on? So you've got in some businesses which are actually rocketing, I mean, you know, food retail, because of stockpiling behaviors, has actually gone up 30%. You know, it's actually grown enormously. And they're doing some quite clever things, I guess, and some interesting collaborations between food retailers, but which in some ways then sort of start to border on monopolies and cartels, slightly disturbingly, like we were touching on last time in terms of these utopian and dystopian narratives. So I don't think they're seeing this as a reset. They're seeing this as a kind of tweaking or a pause or, you know, a temporary aberration of the existing business model. And more concerningly, going back to the kind of the house burnt to the ground metaphor, I mean, because clearly those food retail houses haven't burnt to the ground. You know, if anything, they've been consolidated or they're building some weird extensions out the back. But for sectors like aviation, and you mentioned shipping, you know, you've got a profound moment of potential reset, but what it looks like is happening is actually massive lobbying to not negotiate any type of surrender, but to completely dominate the post-war settlement. Is to say, we want bailouts, we want loans, we want incentives, we want additional discounting, you know, and we're going to take out financing to ensure that we get back to business as usual as quickly as possible with as many planes in the air as soon as we can. And so I think there's a huge still systemic denial about which of those options, whether it's pause or reset, is playing out. But even the resets, I don't think, are going in any kind of different direction. And that, I think, still comes back to, you know, the systemic denial of the fact that while we're continually driven by the fiduciary responsibility and the primacy of shareholder value, we're never going to get beyond that. Even though some short-term decisions have clearly been made, which have been very human and people-focused, ultimately the machine will come back in, and the economics will be put back to the fore. Where it does get a little bit more interesting is in some of the benefit corporation movement, where, you know, a movement which came out of the States, where you have a lot of B Corps, as they're called, where, you know, you rewrite your articles of association to basically put economic value on a par with human and environmental value. So enabling the leaders of those businesses to make much more informed and balanced discussions. That said, you know, that still doesn't question any of the economic growth assumptions. You know, you're not seeing degrowth businesses. You're not seeing anyone, I think, wrestling with, as you described it, that sort of high level impossibility that, you know, everyone wants all the renewable energy that we'll ever produce. And no one's arguing or perhaps looking at how systemically that pie might be cut up, or even if it's possible to deliver. And I think that's where the real fundamental denial starts to come in. I have heard conversations about, you know, steady state businesses, and people actually wanting to adopt an approach to their organization which isn't about growth. And I think one of the arguments I used to have in my old company, when I was told, you know, but Ed, what you're saying needs to be done doesn't fit with, you know, the political and commercial reality in which we find ourselves. And I, you know, like you were saying with your thought experiment, is that I would then say, well, then we've got to change the political and commercial realities, because that's what needs to be done. And I think very few organizations are actually seriously engaged with that idea of limits first. Although there was a news report just yesterday, which I did give me one of those little flickers of like, ah, hang on, this is part of the system potentially waking up. And the excellent Kate Raworth, who wrote Donut Economics in 2017, just announced, you know, that she's working with Amsterdam City Council to say that Amsterdam's reboot recovery will be based on a donut economics type approach. Now, that's radical, because that is essentially saying we're going to start from the position of working out what our basic social foundation is to give people security and well-being, and we're going to look at how that fits within the ecological limits. So that seems to me the start of a very serious conversation, which will mean some very tough decision making for them. And I think, as Kate described it, she said, because Amsterdam, for example, is the world's biggest cocoa importing port, she's highlighted the fact that actually, therefore, Amsterdam's donut economics will also take into consideration the rights and conditions of West African cocoa farmers. Because can you have a large part of the Amsterdam economy which is based on effectively slave or indentured labor? And to me, that's like, wow, okay, if this is serious and they are deciding to base their recovery plan on that type of model, then that's potentially hugely heartening. And I think there are very few businesses which have had the courage or the determination to make that step yet. And perhaps, as always, it will be a public sector institution which will take that first step.
That sounds like a really interesting one to follow. I guess part of what I was thinking about in asking you about this is this just sense that I've had from conversations around the edges and sort of strange encounters along the way, that there's been a growing mass of people on the inside in one place or another who do see the fundamental conflict between the growth assumption and any kind of path that has viability, a living future, whether through the kind of networks growing up around deep adaptation, through the kind of work that somebody like Sam Conniff is doing with the networks that have come out of his book, Be More Pirate, and these kind of mutinies, as they talk about it, within organizations, whether there's been a kind of shadow leadership emerging of people connecting with others within their organizations and across their sectors who do get this stuff, and whether you might see, you know, if the crisis becomes deep enough in terms of the secondary effects of the pandemic into the economic and political, you know, if you see a kind of generational shift or a kind of cohort of people beginning to emerge, that might be very dependent, as you say, on, you know, state and political action, also on grassroots movements and pressure. But I'm just curious whether I'm joining a small number of dots together and seeing more than there is there, or whether there's something there that fits with your experiences of the worlds that you've been moving through.
Well, I think you're right. That the conversation is probably there. I wonder whether your dot joining is drawing out something which is still being held by individuals and is yet turning into those group and collective discussions, and then for not yet getting onto, you know, really serious and significant agendas. I think the seeds are definitely there. And if you'd gone back 10 years ago in for conversations about carbon, you know, where organizations like the Carbon Disclosure Project were trying to get people just to talk about, you know, scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, and in a sort of slightly technical sense. But, you know, now we're in an era, thanks to the galvanization of Extinction Rebellion, and the government's own kind of drawing back of targets, you know, net zero suddenly becomes a conversation which every organization is starting to have to engage in. The destination is not in question. The pace at which you and how you get there is where all the debate is. Now, I suspect the kind of the paradox of infinite growth is the next big, you know, chewy thing that will start to emerge. Because as you say, people are already perhaps feeling this as a discomfort and a discombobulation in their own gut, but it's not yet at the position where it feels perhaps politically or commercially acceptable to be raising this in a conversation within an organization. But that time might be imminent.
Well, that's what I'm wondering is there a way to make the invitation, to offer the frame within which people can come together and have a more visible conversation than was possible even 6 weeks ago about what paths into the future that don't depend on a suicidal trajectory of economic growth look like? Is it possible for people to find more confidence in speaking up things that they were whispering quietly to each other before? And if so, what would it take to help to catalyze that?
Yeah, and I exactly that. It's that permission piece. Now, maybe that is also something which is very much of this moment in time, where the impossible conversations have suddenly become possible. My friend Mark Stevenson always uses a magician's quote, who said, you know, actually only the impossible is interesting. From a magician's perspective, because if people can tell how you're going to do it, there's no mystery of illusion, there's no revelation, there's no epiphany, and there's no transformation of perspective. So I think you're right, and maybe what is needed is that leadership thing to hold a space where that most difficult and painful of questions can be asked, because I think in our context of exploring these narratives, this, as I said earlier, this, I think this is the most sacred cow. This is the most default question that every single news report on the economy will go back to, as if this is the great unifying idea that underpins our society and our civilization, you know. And when the machine has stopped, it is one of those questions that has to be asked. So yeah, I think what you're alluding to is how do we ask that and start that impossible conversation, which I think 20 years ago would have been about sustainability, 10 years ago would have been about net zero, and both of those have been both partly addressed and then surpassed in terms of their capacity to deal with the challenges we face. And perhaps we're now in that next round of, we need to question the orthodoxy of infinite economic growth, because it doesn't serve. It will return us to a trajectory of disaster. And we are in a unique lacuna in time where radically, radically different things could happen.
And I suppose this brings us to one of the thoughts that got a lot of attention in the past week, one of the articulations of a thought, which is Arundhati Roy's article for the Financial Times, where she wrote in very beautiful terms about the way that a pandemic offers a portal, and you know, we have to choose what kind of world we're heading into. I saw that being shared by a lot of people who are probably not Arundhati Roy readers, let me say. I am a big fan of Roy as a writer, and she's an extraordinary kind of activist intellectual. And I also saw some pushback from people who I really respect, or people I find it good to think with, saying, let's be careful about the urge to find a grand transcendental meaning out of the mess of this pandemic. It feels like there's a really difficult line to walk there, which I suppose is part of what we're looking for in these conversations.
I think we have to be very wary of trying to articulate the sort of progressive opportunity, if you like, which comes from disaster in a messianic type of way. I mean, and not least, and having been a sort of self-confessed member of a sustainability cult, if you like, for 20 years, I think, you know, that sort of millenarian tendency that we have all of the answers, or that this is some kind of huge Damascene conversion and transformational moment, when it becomes sort of quasi-religious, and it is about a sort of transcendence, there is a sort of note of caution to be struck there. I mean, what I sort of come back to in the sort of practicalities is the fact, and it's something, you know, another colleague of ours, Vinny Gupta, would say, you know, there's some stuff in the economy which has to die, you know, and if it's not going to die, we're going to have to kill it. And I would soften that slightly by saying, well, okay, how do we give it a good wake? And how do we give a good funeral? How do we start to make informed decisions about what are the type of organization institutions we might wish to help support and work their way through the kind of the tail end of this crisis, and what might be the ritualistic practices that we might have which allow us to let some things go? And I think those are the big questions which I think we might all be forced to sort of confront with it in a bit more depth in the coming weeks.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. These are astonishing times to be living in, times in which many things are revealed, uncovered, brought into a new light. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription, a provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with, and needs a little time and space to breathe. There's a great German word, Fingerspitzengefühle, literally fingertip feeling, the way we might gently sense our way through the dark of a lightless, unfamiliar room. This is an unscripted conversation, a wandering, if you will. And as Tolkien said, not all those who wander are lost. We plan this as a series of informal and roving conversations as we all adventure into uncharted internal and external territories. For us, daring to dream beyond the current urgency does not dismiss or disrespect it. Rather, it honours it. Whether we like it or not, our futures are already being decided today. Please do comment, ask questions and respond. You can find us on Facebook at The Great Humbling. This is initiation at a cultural scale. Please come and join us on this emergent journey.